Hello and welcome to Working Historians, a podcast series where we discuss what historians do with their lives. I am Rob Denning, Associate Dean for Liberal Arts for Southern New Hampshire University's online history programs. Today's episode is our first to ever feature a live audience. This is our first event in the Southern New Hampshire University's History Speaker Series, which will bring professional historians, students, faculty, and staff together to talk about research projects, new publications, and history-related careers. Today's event features Dr. Luke Peterson, who teaches Middle Eastern history at Southern New Hampshire University and other universities, and has written a new book, The U.S. Military in the Print News Media, Service and Sacrifice in Contemporary Discourse. Let's listen. I want to thank everybody for joining me here today at the first event of our new History Speakers Series that's hosted by the SNHU Online History Programs. I am Rob Denning. I'm the Associate Dean of Liberal Arts for Southern New Hampshire University. I oversee the undergrad and graduate history programs, the online programs. And I'm pleased to talk to Dr. Luke Peterson today. Got a little bit of a biography for Dr. Peterson here. Luke has a Bachelor of Arts degree in history from the University of Texas, a Master's of Liberal Arts degree from St. Edward's University, and a Master of Arts in Middle Eastern Studies from the University of Texas. Completed a PhD at the University of Cambridge, King's College, in the Faculty of Asian and Middle Eastern Studies, investigating language, media, and knowledge surrounding the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Dr. Peterson has published in the British Journal of Middle Eastern Studies, has chapters in multiple anthologies, a monograph entitled Palestine in the American Mind, The Discourse on Palestine in the Contemporary United States, and a book entitled Palestine, Israel in the Print News Media, Contending Discourses. Dr. Peterson's latest book, which is on the screen right now, which we are talking about, is The U.S. Military in the Print News Media, Service and Sacrifice in Discourse, which was published just this month by Anthem Press London. I just got an email from, I believe it's your one of your editors there the other day, saying that it just went live as of, I want to say it was a week or two ago. So congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thanks for all that very kind words, Rob. Yeah, I think the live date was April 2nd, 2024. So it is
very cool.
Figuratively and literally hot off the presses. So.
Yeah. Dr. Peterson is also a regular contributor of articles on market policies, politics, and foreign affairs for the magazine Islamic Horizons. Dr. Peterson moved to Pittsburgh in the fall of 2014 to take up the post of visiting assistant professor in contemporary international studies at the University of Pittsburgh's Global Studies Center for the academic year 2014. He joined the International Relations Department at Duquesne University as an instructor of Arabic in the fall of 2017, and Chatham, I hope that's pronounced Chatham?
Chatham, exactly.
All right, good. Chatham University's History and Politics Department in the same semester. Dr. Peterson joined the History Department at SNHU here in the spring of 2022. And from Pittsburgh, Dr. Peterson contributes to local, national, and international media coverage on topics related to the politics, history, and culture of the contemporary Middle East. So first off, thank you for joining us. And I would like to thank everybody in the audience for taking time out to come join us also in this first event in the History Speakers Series. This will be an ongoing event, which I'll say a little bit more about as we get to the end of the program here. But let's start off by talking, Dr. Peterson, let's talk a little bit about your background. I mean, I just read off a whole bunch of really cool sounding degrees and job titles and all of that. But tell us a little bit about your background. What are your interests? What led you to discussing the U.S. military, print media, and discourse?
Yeah, well, thank you for setting this up, Dean Denning, and thanks for everyone for being in attendance. It's a nice long bio that you read, and I don't know if that's because I've done a lot or because I'm just old now. But as the bio gets longer, it makes me feel slightly longer in the tooth as well. But I was just a regular kind of a college kid, and you know, I grew up in San Antonio, Texas. I went to the University of Texas. It was sort of the place that many or most of us went from my big public Texas high school, who were sort of artsy or liberal was the term we probably would have used to describe ourselves then, or kind of critical in our mindset about the world, maybe progressive although I don't think we would have said that in the 90s. And I wanted to study history. I really enjoyed history. I liked reading about it. And I really had a mindset that, you know, you only get one chance at these things in life. So I wanted to study something that I wanted to study and not something that sort of had a vocation in mind necessarily. And so I studied history, and I ended up getting a teaching certification in the state of Texas and taught high school for a few years before sort of circling around back to academia. And my interest in the Middle East probably began as early as that undergraduate degree, where my brother had an apartment, and this was a very cool place for us to hang out as 18, 19-year-old kids. And my brother was older, and his friends were older, and they were vastly cooler and more connected to the culture of Austin, Texas in the 90s than we were. And that was a great place to be because it was, you know, the sort of Richard Linklater years and the you know, the birth of guys like Matthew McConaughey, and you know, Austin film became a thing, and Austin music became a really big thing in the 90s. And we sort of formed our band together and started playing, you know, shows in Austin. And so that was a very exciting time. But one of the neighbors that my brother had was himself Palestinian, and his the other neighbor on the other in that same apartment is one of the professors who's blurred my book. His name is Andy Clarno. And he and I became friends then, and we're still friends now. And he started to speak to me about conflict in the Middle East and politics and history and foreign policy in a way that really started to open my eyes and make me think about these things in a different way, which sort of sponsored me to studying at a serious level. My senior level seminar was about the Middle East, and I remember writing a very long paper about the PLO for that class. Left it alone for a while, went back, taught high school back in San Antonio, kind of disengaged and didn't think about an academic career. But as in the early 2000s, as the second intifada was coming on, and as the U.S. role in the region was coming under more critical scrutiny, I thought that it was something I wanted to know better and know more deeply. And so I returned to grad school, and that was the first master's program you mentioned, a place called St. Edward's University. It's a small Catholic university back in Austin. And I worked with a professor there who I don't think is with us anymore, and it's a real shame. The world lost a real, really important person and an activist for peace and justice, and her name was Carol Walker. And Carol Walker had lived in Lebanon during the Civil War, and she had cut cane with Vincent Ramos brigades in Cuba in the 1970s. She was a really old style, long lived activist and progressive thinker and writer and teacher. And she was very, very inspirational. Carol put me in touch with the group that invited Westerners to live in the West Bank and to do solidarity work with different civic organizations working in the West Bank. This was not direct engagement with Israeli soldiers or anything like this. This was just working in different research centers, daycare centers, working with civic programs and projects in the Palestinian West Bank. And so I did that in 2004 and began to pick up Arabic there and sort of learning more about the culture and the circumstance in Palestine specifically. That then sponsored, once I finished that first master's program, my transition to a second master's program at the University of Texas, which kind of required a pre-existing knowledge about the Middle East and at least some level of contact with the culture, specifically the language of the region. And so I had that and I got accepted to that program, and it was a great group to work with, a really intense cohort, really great professors, very intense grad work in the early middle aughts, 5 to 7, I did that. And I worked with who is today known as the author of the quintessential and instructional manual to teach Arabic as a second language. Her name is Kristen Brustad. She was the supervisor of my master's thesis, and she and I began speaking in theoretical terms about language and knowledge and the ways in which these frames operate in society. And, you know, she, again, invaluable aid and invaluable mentor to me in my academic career, who also happened to know a professor in England working on similar topics. And I have a background, my mother is English, and I'd lived in England for a time as a kid, and I had traveled there quite a lot in my teens and 20s. And so I thought it would be great to have an opportunity to study at Cambridge, and I did. And I went to work with that professor there, ultimately finished my PhD with a different professor, an American, actually, another American academic and a linguist, a very good guy. And so kind of then wrote that book, my first book, my first sort of solid independent book, Palestine, Israel, and the Print News Media. And that sponsored me to get hired to a terminal position here in Pittsburgh. And my family and I just like Pittsburgh so much. We've been here ever since. So that's a sort of a roundabout way of maybe fleshing out some of those details there.
Great. And I think a lot of that stuff will probably come back up a little bit in the conversation as we go along here, because I see some of that popping up in the book itself. And so I'm looking forward to getting going on that. So before we get too deep into the weeds here, why don't you tell us about what is this book about? What's the big storyline of this book? And then we can talk in more detail.
Yeah. You know, it's at once a direct and an easy question to answer, while also being a really big and difficult question to get your head around, to get my head around. The theoretical frames that propelled me to the work I did as a PhD student are very much with me in this book as well. I haven't abandoned those frames, and I certainly haven't abandoned the methodology. The methodology is the same effectively as I applied when I was a PhD student. But the question that really drove me in writing my book as a PhD student and in writing this book as well was, how do we know what we know? Right? How is it that we have frames of knowledge that are, you know, there's lots of different terms or lots of different ways to name these concepts. Some of which we could call, you know, a cultural taboo, or you could call it a sacred cow, or you could call it a presumption. I use lots of different ways. I try to be as rangy as possible in the book to describe what I'm calling a trope or a theme, or, you know, a term that I think I innovated, a frame of representation. These things that are just sort of in our cultural space, and more importantly, probably for me and my arguments, in our intellectual space. How is it that we know what we know? And that's a very, like I say, it's a simple question. How is it that we know what we know? But the diffuse nature of the answer to that question, I think, makes it very difficult to create scholarship around. And I hope I was honest in this book to say this is a single study that has come nowhere near to encapsulating the entirety of the discussion on what the position of the U.S. military in 21st century American society, right? The position of the U.S. military in 20th century American society. I've maybe just chipped a few edges off the surface, but there is so much more to say and to do and to work with around those topics. But effectively, that single question is the driver. How is it that we know what we know?
And so in this specific example, you're looking for, how do we know what we know about the U.S. military?
That's right.
And so what's your, you know, your elevator pitch? What's your main thrust of the argument there?
I mean, maybe some more about my background will help elucidate that question. So, you know, I am the product of the U.S. military myself, very directly. My father was in the military for 23 years, and he still has a very, very warm feeling about that. He wasn't old enough to, he would have been old enough to go to the Vietnam War, but he was assigned differently during the 60s and 70s. With a lot of nostalgia and a lot of veneration talked about his career in the military. I remember, you know, as a kid. And then, you know, again, we grew up in Texas, and specifically in San Antonio, Texas, which still today has, you know, five or six, I think the number today is five, very, very large military bases, one of which, Randolph Air Force Base, was just a sort of a stone's throw away from my high school in a place called Converse, Texas. And so it occurred to me throughout my PhD study and throughout my graduate work that the U.S. military had a particular place of veneration, a particular air of sort of a protection as an institution in the United States. It is something that and I mentioned this in the book, right? We can point to any domestic or foreign policy topic really under the sun, and the two mega parties that exist in the United States today would have very different and probably very antagonistic views on that topic. And yet we come to a discussion and understanding of expanding the U.S. military budget, increasing the personnel, increasing the footprint of the U.S. military in the world, And nearly unanimously, every politician of note, every politician at the federal level, and I say nearly unanimously, has that agenda in lockstep. They're in agreement with that. And that was a sort of a state of affairs that I wanted to analyze. Right? Why? If these politicians and representatives are of us, are they from our culture? They're from our collective background. What are the intellectual conditions of that culture that creates this near unanimous approval of a massive military industry, a massive defense and arms industry, and then this massive amount of money and influence and input it has upon policy and the world? And that's the specific nature of what it is I'm trying to analyze here.
And so you're looking at the U.S. military as kind of this entity that enjoys bipartisan support for the most part. Sure, there's going to be some nibbling around the edges for different parties and all of that. But
right.
In general, the U.S. military is held up as an institution, an honorable institution that is worthy of continued public funding and all of that. And so you're looking at how that has been supported by the media, essentially.
Specifically the media, more broadly, the word, that I come to become infatuated with is by discourse, right? And so I want to be clear that the print media especially has, as I started this research and as I'm looking at various different U.S. wars and engagement from the Spanish-American War through to the second invasion of Iraq, the print media, I think it's probably easy to argue that it waned in terms of its influence. By the early 21st century, you're looking at much more to do with cable news cycles and much more to do with internet. And you have a differentiating relationship between media consumer and media producer. And the media consumer can often insert a perspective, an opinion, a talk back is one of the ways it's described. And so it's a little more nebulous. Maybe it's a lot more nebulous. But so I wanted the print media as a researcher for me as a scholar is easy to sort of frame, easier to frame in us on a page. It doesn't have the undefined edges of the internet, and I'm eliminating audio and video in these analyses to keep it a manageable piece of work. And again, there are media scholars looking at audio and video and those representations, and there are some very important works around that and around the military and around policy as well. This was to keep one consistent form of media production over a larger span of time to therefore marry the two elements together, the history and the media study and discourse analysis.
And so generally you're book is arguing that the media, the print media, is essentially, saying that it's a PR wing of the military is probably going too far. But generally, the print media has been very supportive of this discourse that supports that venerates the U.S. military, and that's generally been consistent throughout this entire time span.
Right? Yeah, I think that's fair. I would say that especially authoritative print publications that you would be able to name, and right, it spans the country. We could look at the different coasts and different elements of production leading up to a war, in while the U.S. is engaged in a war, and then in the immediate aftermath of that war, those publications look and frame that they look similar. They frame the media, the military's engagement in a very similar and a very mutually compatible way. And so I would say, and they then advocate very strongly for a very broad and robust military presence. One of the important exceptions that should be noted is that there were many more authoritative print publications in the early months of 2003, perhaps as late as the late months of 2002, and I go into this in the book, the Valerie Plame story and the Joseph Wilson memo that revealed that Saddam Hussein was nowhere close to discovering anything like weapons of mass destruction, and certainly nowhere close to anything like a sustainable nuclear program. that then the institution of the government itself under the Bush administration isolated those voices and ejected those voices from the administration. The media, there were some important reporters catching on to that story and publicizing that story as a moment for pause. I would argue, and again, I understand this is an arguable statement, I would argue those voices in the media were overwhelmed by a bigger push towards what ultimately was the U.S. invasion of Iraq in March of 2003. So there are exceptions, and it's no such institution as a monolith, but I'm looking at broader trends.
Yeah, and this the book actually, in many ways, it actually took me back to my college days when I was reading a lot of for various courses and for various projects, I was reading a lot of Wisconsin School type books on foreign policy, William Eppman Williams and Walter Lefebvre, and I had a couple of professors at my undergrad and my MA degree institution who were very fiery leftist historians who presented that side of it as kind of, you know, the gospel almost. And so some aspects of your argument took me back to that. But another one that it took me back to is, I don't know if you're familiar with the work of William Dorman, who was a journalism professor at Sacramento State. I took one of his classes and he wrote a book on the U.S. press in Iran where he categorized it, or he kind of named this relationship between the media and the government as what he called the journalism of deference, where the journalists, because for a variety of reasons, either they ideologically agreed with the need for whatever operation the military was engaged in, or simply because they didn't have access to any other alternative information because of classification or whatever, a lot of the journalists. And he was using the example of Iran in the wake of the Iranian Revolution. But the argument is basically that the journalism industry kind of was deferential to the government and the military's kind of storyline for a variety of reasons. It sounds like you've got kind of a similar story going here, even if you're not using that specific term.
Yeah, I'm familiar with those arguments, and I think there is a lot of crossover. I think that's smart to point that out. One of the issues at the federal level in particular is an issue of access, and there's a multi-layers whereby a story becomes many sort of gatekeepers whereby a news story becomes mainstream authoritative news, how I would define mainstream authoritative news, talking about U.S. foreign policy, talking about a war, talking about the military, something like this. And one of the layers is just you need to have somebody who's in close to policymakers and the Joint Chiefs and the Office of the President and the Secretary of State and Secretary of all these high-ranking, and the way that we talk about them in the culture today is almost as if, kind of representative on a hill. Like, we don't really have access to them. We have to be able to engage their decision making through intermediaries. The media is that intermediary. The news media is that intermediary. So without the kind of access without the kind of deference that you speak of, or the journalism of deference, which I think is a really useful phrase, you begin to lose the kind of access. So very famously, the work that I think started, helped start me on this path is Herman and Chomsky's Manufacturing Consent, talking about the ways in which back to the original question, how it is we know what we know. Our frames of knowledge are constructed by the fact that we don't have a huge range of massive ideological opinion represented in the pages of the authoritative print news media. There are no overtly socialist voices in those pages. There are no overtly communist voices in those pages. There are no overtly anarchist voices advocating for removal of borders or in redistribution of wealth, or these sort of what you might picture a position as radical ideas are only encapsulated in radical publications. And so we can easily shift those conversations to one side of our intellectual frame and then push ourselves towards what's left. And that intellectual frame becomes narrower. it has to do with the kind of access that I think you were referring to, the kind of deference that you're referring to when you say that policymakers don't engage. You don't get access to those policymakers in asserting those certain, you know, you can only get access with assertion of a certain point of view or I would say a limited frame of view. And so, yeah, that scholarly tradition, I certainly was hoping to tap into that in this work as well. Yeah.
And one of the points that you made, I believe it was, it kind of permeates the book, but you made the point explicitly, I believe, in the first chapter, but is the idea that the U.S. has been at war for, I forget the exact numbers, but, you know, 180 years out of 185 years. I forget exactly what the numbers were, but for the most of modern American history, the U.S. has been at war.
Yeah.
Even when we outside of the warfare community might think, well, yeah, there was Spanish-American War, and then there was a lull, and then there was World War One, and then there was a lull, and then World War Two. And the chapters in your book kind of talk about kind of the mainstream, or not the mainstream, but the incidents that we think about when we think of warfare in the 20th century. You got Vietnam, Iraq, the World Wars. And so, but your other point was that, again, that the U.S. was at war really constantly since the Spanish-American War. There have only been a handful of years when the U.S. wasn't actually at war.
Right.
And so the case studies that you had here make sense, but I'm just wondering what you have to say about those kind of interstitial periods when there's kind of the low grade conflict that didn't really blow up into a world war or one of the big name wars that we all study in our 20th century history classes. What about those other lower stakes, maybe not lower stakes, but lower scale kind of slow burns that are happening around the planet?
But it's a really fair and good question, Rob, and a smart one. It's one that I've been preparing to defend myself against since I started writing this book, knowing full well that I was going to be limited in my frame. So there's the editorial answer. The editorial answer is that they gave me X number of words, and they gave me X number of time, and they said, do your worst, right? Do the damage that you're going to do. And I began the first table of contents I submitted to the publisher, I think it was 12 chapters. And they said, okay, but you're not going to get there. And I said, watch me. And then 3 months later, I said, yeah, guess what? I'm not going to get there. Can I do 10 chapters? They said, yeah, carry on. And then I said, 3-4 months later, I said, can I do 8 chapters? And they said, yeah, because the type of analysis I'm doing, analysis of language itself, is very language intensive, or at least the way I do it, it's language intensive. Maybe my wife is right. Maybe I could be more efficient in my use of words. But so that's one. The editorial answer is one. Number two, I think that your assertion at the top is my assertion at the top of the book. I want to be very clear that we recognize ourselves as in 21st century United States of America as a nation that is dependent upon warfare. And I so much so that I have become cynical for politicos and policymakers who declare otherwise. We depend upon warfare for our ideological purpose. We depend upon warfare for our sort of there's an economy around it that is massive and incalculable if you break it down to the level of jobs. And then it becomes a level of constituencies in various different electoral areas around the country who depend upon those jobs and then lean upon those representatives to get to the Defense Department and get more contracts. And it becomes a repetitive and an existential cycle that we are in the middle of now. I don't see a future where we have broken that cycle without radical change in our. So that's the background of the conversation. And then I want to sort of focus on the elements of the wars that you mentioned, of Spanish-American War, World War I, World War II, Vietnam. And I think I probably wrote the Vietnam chapter first because it was just so big in my childhood of the 80s. And, you know, the idea of trying to exorcise demons of Vietnam. And I didn't quite understand what that meant as a child, but you become more conversant with those ideas as an adult and as an academic. And so That the umbrella of here is an existence of a state at war. Here are the explosive and highly attended moments of a media looking at that state from within that state. And that's sort of how I ended up structuring the book.
Yeah, and I did not at all mean that to be a criticism of the book. I totally understand the, you know, the scale of a book, the publication, yeah. And we'll talk a little bit about the publication.
Yeah, you're allowed. Thanks. That's not at all. I hope I didn't sound offensive. Fair one. And when I thought about it, obviously before, yeah.
Yeah. No. And who knows? You know, that may be something to follow up in your next book. Who knows? But yeah, I was kind of curious, because it does make sense for the purpose of this book here, because this book is not nowhere in here do you claim to be the authority on all of, you know, the American military throughout American history. So the book is not, I don't want to pretend the book is, you know, it is meant to be something that it's not. It's a bunch of case studies, which I think are very effective case studies. But it is interesting to think about the kind of the connections between all of the, you know, what's happening between those various conflicts.
Absolutely, yes, yeah.
And I was also kind of wondering, and this is outside the scope of the book a bit, but I'm curious to kind of think what you think is going to happen going forward. But you mentioned before that the print media has kind of gone into decline in favor of cable news and, you know, the websites that are kind of splashing the sensationalist headline of the day and all of that. And those websites can be much more splintered than the mainstream authoritative sources of the past. So I'm curious, what do you think going forward this would look like to whoever, you know, whether it's you or someone else that picks up on this, how carrying this forward to like Afghanistan or Ukraine, or, you know, whatever, if the U.S. gets involved in Ukraine, but whatever future conflicts the U.S. gets involved with, where the print media does play a much less influential role, do you think it's going to still be possible to focus on the print media by itself, or will it have to be a much more expansive view of all the digital media, print media, and all of that too?
Yeah, that's another really, really important question. So two elements there to me, I think are important from my purview as a researcher. It's important to acknowledge a change. The first element that where I think a critical and understudied and underemphasized change is taking place is a public admission of the fact that we are no longer fighting wars with measured objectives in a measured space and time. And then once those objectives are completed and that measured space and time has been conquered or defeated, or insert your phrase, your preferred phrase, then that war is over and we reduce our military efforts and we go back to a nation of peace and prosperity. That is not, and the most informative scholar who helped me understand that is himself a former military officer. His name is Andrew Basevich, as a historian at Boston University. He's fantastic in this criticism, not only because he lost a son in the Iraq War, but because he himself was a military officer, and because he was a colonel or lieutenant colonel, I think colonel, before he left, and had a lot of policy conversations around this idea. We are not a nation fighting a war with limited objectives. We're fighting a war into perpetuity, almost Orwellian in its conception, that we have a concept to defeat. That concept is terrorism or insurgency or, you know, anti-democracy. However it's framed, it is not meant to be sporadic and pointed. It's meant to be or acute. We should think of it as a chronic condition. We exist in this condition. Now, that's number one. Number two, you mentioned the new forms of media, and I think that it requires a new theoretical frame. I think that to objectively understand the role of media, we have to account for the proliferation of the citizen journalist, which is now as much more common than it was certainly in the Vietnam era, probably easily as well in the first Gulf War was another case study I have. We don't have an institute. It's much more lateral and much more diffuse. Journalism as a concept, journalism as a profession, becomes a thing that we can now do with satellite uploads and video photography from our phone and interviews on the ground. And so that differentiation of the profession plus the technological aspects you mentioned, which are critical, added on to the differentiation of concept around the military industry, the military institution, those things will change the way that these phenomena are understood.
Yeah, and the citizen journalist that you're talking about, I think there's that issue, but then there's also just social media, where anybody feels entitled to add their opinion to anything. And I've said on numerous occasions that I feel really bad for future historians who want to try to study, you know, the 2010s and the 2020s and have to wade through, you know, 10 million Twitter posts and all of that garbage to try to find the few nuggets of useful information within all of the chaff is going to be, I just feel for future historians that have to do that. And I'm thinking that in a situation like this, this is the type of project that would possibly have to wade through all of that stuff. And
it would. There may be a way to motivate, say, AI to begin to whittle down the chaff, as I think you adequately put it, for the elements of critical contribution to journalism or critical contribution to scholarship that bear analysis. I don't know. I mean, and again, that's at best a double-sided sword from what AI poses in the 21st century. And I don't know that has been applied to scholarship of discourse analysis or journalist studies. It hasn't happened. I'm just not aware of it yet.
Yeah, I'm sure it will. I mean, once we start developing large language models where we incorporate all of the vast volume of Twitter feeds and all of that, it could be disastrous or it could be really interesting.
I can see it going both ways. Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah. So what can you tell us, since we've got a lot of students in the audience here who are probably interested to hear about kind of the practical the non-fun research side of being a historian, but can you describe quickly the publication process for this book? You talked a little bit about it, but you know, if you've written a, you know, an MA thesis or a dissertation or some other major research topic, what do you do if you want to try to get that published?
I mean, for my PhD dissertation, I shopped it. I made sure that I was sending regular emails, getting into contacts, leveraging. I think it's what in the business world people call networking. But I've never in my life been in the business world, so I guess that's what they call it. I don't really know. But I made sure that people who knew me and had a good thought about me were using their contacts to get a hold of publishers and you know, people who might be into academic journal. I didn't necessarily conceive of my first major break, I think, was in that end, was probably that my master's thesis was picked up and put in an anthology. And that I just leveraged that all the way to the, and it's probably because of Kristen Brusset and her work at the University of Texas. And they organized a panel and I was a presenter, and that ended up being the work that was first published in a, you know, an authoritative academic kind of a way. I shot that right to the top of my CV. I carried on studying, and I would take any chance. I used to think of it as, and again, to bring it back to my background as a college student in Austin in the 1990s, and we played in shows, you know, we had a rock band, and we had the kind of rule in the band was you couldn't turn a gig down. There's no showcase we would say no to. We played at Tuesday nights at 2 a.m. We played at Sunday mornings at 8 a.m. We played anytime and anywhere. So I never took an offer of publication, even if it seemed minuscule and meaningless, even if I wasn't paid for it, which mostly I never was. Mostly I'm still not, right? Most historians don't get paid for their publications. I always did it, and I always would make sure I got all the details from that citation to put on my CV, and I just started building and started building. So there's no such thing as wasted effort in that regard, right? There's great effort because you're polishing your craft as a writer, because you're improving your CV as an academic and as a scholar. If it doesn't come to fruition, if it doesn't hit, there'll be another thing, and there'll be another thing. And you just sort of keep, you know, pounding the rock, as it were. You keep working towards that break. And so in my PhD dissertation, I shopped it. I mean, I really hounded those presses, especially UK-based presses that I knew would be interested in something like that, something around discourse, something around media, something around language. My PhD professor at Cambridge, Bert Fox, he helped me a lot with that process. And then in this case, and this is rare, but what happened was Anthem Press contacted me, and they said they found my my profile online, and they said, "We see you published this book on discourse. We have a gap in our media study and discourse study section. What do you think you could do for us? Could you give us a book proposal?" And I said, "You know, give me a couple of months," and I submitted it. And then it's a process. And I remember submitting the book proposal. I mean, it would have been in 2021, I think, December of 21. Waited for several months to hear back. They say, "We like it. We're going to shop it a little bit." And then I got reviewers with comments, and I had to incorporate those comments and send them an updated proposal. And then they said, "We like that. And here's your contract." And then the contract then allowed me to start writing in earnest. But even, and I'll tell you, Rob, for the audience as well, none of that came with a paycheck, right? There was never a moment in that process where they said, "Here's your advance, Dr. Peterson. You're such a hotshot academic. You're so smart. You're so brilliant. You're so wonderful. Here's money." No one said that. And so I really committed in this project in particular to the project itself for its own value. I didn't want it for a paycheck. I didn't want it for accolades. I didn't have today in mind, in this lovely conversation we're having in mind. I had it in mind for the sake of the thing itself. And if I put my best intentions towards that, that was really liberating. And that was really, it really let me go and let me be myself as a writer and as a scholar and as a critic. And I advise students who are going down that path to do the same thing. Be yourself, use your own voice, and don't worry about you need to worry about paying bills and feeding yourselves and turning the lights on. But the actual idea of, "I'm going to have a book on the shelf next to Naomi Klein. I'm going to have a book on the shelf next to Noam Chomsky." Dispense with that notion right now and do the work that you find that's valuable and important. And that will be its own reward. And it's a very important reward as well.
Yeah, it's good to mention the lack of paycheck, because that's kind of a common misconception, is that we get paid for writing history books. And Sure, there are some that do the top 2% of people who sell the most books, they get paid for it. But the vast majority of historians don't get paid at all for
it. Exactly.
There may be a couple of residuals checks for a few bucks here and there, but for the most part, it's not. And that stems from a long kind of history, because, you know, the history profession has kind of believed that this is part of your normal job duties as a full-time tenured professor. Unfortunately, that's a bit out of date now that we are in a kind of a post-tenure world where there are very few people who actually are employed full-time anymore. So unfortunately, the publication system hasn't really caught up to that reality yet. And it's not going to, because it's not in their interest to start paying the authors. They have an established system, and so they're not going to start paying historians, regardless of kind of the economic plight that historians may find themselves in as the tenure system kind of collapses around us.
And I'll just say, Rob, to that point, and stop me if I go on too long, but that is actually inextricably connected to the arguments that I make here in the book. Because the might of the military as an institution, and the way it's protected in contemporary news discourse, then leads us to an uncritical examination of what it means to be in the contemporary culture in the 21st century United States. And the way that I phrase it at the end, in the conclusion of the book, is to think about healthcare. And you think, well, you need a good job and a regular full-time job to have healthcare. A lot of kids coming out of high school, not successful enough in high school, or didn't have the support, because there's another conversation around education we could have, to go into a university. So what are your options? And say, well, look, go into the military, enlist in the military. You have prestige, you have honor, you have the modicum of service attached to yourselves, and then you get healthcare. And then later you can get an education. But we have long ago ceased to think of something like healthcare or education as human rights. It's as a right of the citizen of a country the country should be providing those things to the vast majority of its citizenship if it's at all capable, if it could all afford it. But the United States says, no, we don't provide those things to you en masse. We provide for you a method by which you could have those things paid for, and that's called the U.S. military. And then a lot of 18, 19, 20-year-old kids say, okay, well, I'll join the military. What are the consequences? So there's a massive – the economic concept here is opportunity cost. There's a massive opportunity cost that we are foregoing in the culture by propping up one mighty institution at the expense of other potential ways to navigate human society and coexistence. And I think the consequences of that from the discourse that I try to analyze in the book are long-lasting and pretty profound.
Yep, and we're about 45 minutes in. I figure at this point maybe we can open up to some questions from the audience. I'm scrolling through the chat thread now, and I can see one question from the audience. Have you found that the relationship between the authoritative media, as you were describing them, and the military were prescriptive, or could it be more attributed to a natural synergy between the media and the military? Presumably we're talking like similar mindset, similar goals and intentions, that kind of thing.
It's a great question. I think the answer is it's both. And the one example that I think of in terms of prescriptive relationships between the media and the U.S. military, I'll give you one snippet from the book, it's one element of the conversation here around World War II. After the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the U.S. military, the U.S. Army sent a general by the name of Farrell, F-A-R-R-E-L-L, to specifically liaise with the press in Japan, the U.S. press, who were positioned in Japan to kind of come to some understanding around the idea of what had just happened. It was a cataclysmic event. It was catastrophically destructive to those two industrial cities in Japan. And Farrell's job was to smooth that decision-making, smooth those events out as much as possible to the press who were there specifically to write that story. UPI and AP, lots of press agents and international press as well, but my study, of course, is of American journalists. And the way that he did it was to confirm again and again and again, and you can see his name pop up in the hundreds of news articles I read about this particular period of time. His name comes up again and again and again and again. He's one of the most quoted figures in the late summer, early autumn months of 1945 in the U.S. Press, that there had been no nuclear explosion, that the explosions at Hiroshima and Nagasaki were conventional, exclusively conventional. They were big bombs, yes, but they had no radiation. They had no nuclear capacity. So you see this story rehashed and his name again in various quotes around from Seattle to L.A. to Chicago to New York to Washington and many points in between. So that is, I would call, a prescriptive relationship between the military and the press. They want this story to look like this, and they give it to this mouthpiece, and he gives it then to the press, and that happens. That absolutely does happen. There's other examples in the book like that about Iraq and a few other points in time. So I think the short answer is it's both, but the prescriptive answer for me is much more telling.
I actually had another question. Thanks for talking, of course. It's very interesting. And my field of study is really much more ancient, so I don't have a good grasp on this. But from my understanding, the media and the government had a big disconnect during the Vietnam War. Do you address that in your book? Or am I incorrect for having that assumption?
I wouldn't say it's incorrect. I would say, so remember, the span of time of direct U.S. military involvement in Vietnam is more than a decade. It lasted from roughly 1963 and a troop buildup initiated by President Kennedy to 1975. And so over that span of time, and again, I hope I'm very clear about this in the book, there's just a huge amount of material that's produced by the print news media. And then by the late 1960s, in the early 1970s, television makes a major appearance on the news media scene in the United States. And television becomes a sort of a center point, a feature of American families' looking about information about Vietnam, particularly the evening news right around dinner time. And so much so that there was one very famous moment of the ARVN, the Southern Vietnamese Army, having captured a spy, and one of the commanders of a platoon there puts a pistol against that spy's head and pulls the trigger, shoots him, kills him. And that was broadcast live into American television audience. So, and that became, again, a shocking moment in the relationship between media and military and American cultural perspective. So there was, by the end, especially in 72, 73, 74, a ton of criticism from the authoritative press about the potential outcome of the Vietnam War. And some, by the time Politico's in 1968 and 69 began saying things like, we need an exit strategy from Vietnam, and then we have criticism. So I wouldn't go so far as to say that the media and the government divorce entirely. There's still a lot of very, very long lasting holding strong media voices advocating for an extended presence in Vietnam. But there is certainly enough of a voice by that point in time, as I say, late 60s, early 70s, to find criticism about government policy in Southeast Asia than in the media. Yes.
Yeah, and I think I think that's reflective of the American culture as a whole, because, yes, there certainly were a lot of very high profile protesters against the war, especially after 68, 69 and onward. There weren't very many of them before 68, but there were some. But there were also always counter protesters happening.
Correct.
All the time. Also, for every big, massive anti-war protest, usually across the street, maybe not reported on as much, but there's usually going to be a counter protest of people that are supporting the war effort. I think Absolutely. That probably plays out in the journalism sphere also, is that you're going to have some that are going to be challenging the administration's view and all of that, but there's still going to be a sizable component, especially of more conservative journalists who, not from a bipartisan perspective, but small c conservative, who are going to be a bit more protective of the war's, the war's reputation may not be the right way to put it, but that they're a bit more, they're a bit more pro war effort than not. So I think that's probably a kind of a general split among all these different groups.
Well, that's it. That's smart too, right? Absolutely right. And I think it's the, you say the war's reputation. I would say it's the country's reputation. Say it's the country's reputation because of the position that the U.S. military holds in our own self-conception, right? Our own construction of our own national identity. And that's I think, an important point.
Great. We've got another question in the chat here, which is a bit more general about the history profession, not really necessarily about your book. But we've got a question that says, I've been super worried about finding a career with a history degree. If we remove teacher from the list of jobs, would you say that it's difficult to find a career with a history degree? I have some thoughts on that, but do you have any initial thoughts on that?
I think it is difficult. I think it was difficult when I started looking in the early aughts, late 90s, and I was quite happy to be a teacher. I was a classroom teacher for a number of years until I was happy to do it until I wasn't happy to do it anymore, kind of thing. I think the thing that the silver lining might be that the avenues by which you would find support, find a way to network, find a way to write a CV that's particularly appealing to a certain industry, I think those are more numerous today than they were when I was first starting out. But I don't think that necessarily means that the process is necessarily easy. It may just be that you have more work to do in different directions. But Dean Denning would be the person to ask. He knows that stuff much better than I do.
Yeah, I mean, this in many ways, this question is the central question that got me going on the Working Historians podcast to begin with back in 2017, right. Was to try to give some sense to students of what career opportunities are available out there if you're not going to go into traditional academia. While the vast majority of us would love to get the tenure track professor job with the elbow patches and all of that cool stuff, that just doesn't happen much anymore.
That's
the
right.
Universities around the world, but especially in the U.S., have kind of gradually discarded the tenure system that was kind of the model for a big chunk of the post-war period. I don't want to pretend like this was the norm going back all that far. But, you know, that was just, that was the norm. And that was, at least in our, you know, our popular conception of academia, that's the way people tend to envision it for a long time. And, but that's just not the case anymore. There's most tenure track positions, when people retire, they don't get replaced by other, tenure track. The track goes away, and a lot of those those professors get replaced by adjunct instructors, because they still need someone to teach the class, but they'd rather teach, they'd rather pay part-time wages and without benefits and all of that. So, yeah, the traditional tenure track, it's there. You know, the fortunate 1 or 2% of PhDs will get those jobs, but the vast majority do not. And so, the reality that historians need to find some other alternative is what drove the creation of that podcast. So on the one hand, you know, I invite everybody to go back and listen to the 120-ish episodes that are in that podcast feed. But the general story, or the kind of the big picture that has come out of those 120-ish conversations, is that you really have to be creative in what you're looking for. It's not going to be enough to just type the word historian into a job search, because a lot of jobs don't actually use the word historian. However, there's a lot of jobs out there that actually use and need the skills of the historian. So what I always encourage students to do is think about, after you've graduated with a history degree, what are you now really good at? You're really good at identifying useful sources, primary sources, secondary sources. You're good at analyzing those sources to figure out what does, you know, what does this source mean? Who wrote it? Why did they write it? What was the purpose? What information can I glean from this source? And then you've taken all of those sources and you've put them together and to try to understand a topic. So you've asked a research question, you've done the searches for sources, you've analyzed sources, you've created a mass, you could, you know, if you want to think about it this way, you've created a massive database of primary sources and secondary sources, and now you're analyzing those sources to draw some sort of a conclusion. And then once you've drawn that conclusion, you are sharing that conclusion through reports or through books or through emails or whatever the case may be, but you're disseminating that information to an audience, and you're writing for that audience. All of that stuff is what historians do, but every workplace in the world is looking for someone that can do that effectively. And so the question becomes, you know, what is the topic that you're going to be doing all of that stuff for? Is it a historical topic, or is it, you know, the share prices for Microsoft in the last 3 months or something along those lines? So regardless of what the actual topic is, you've got skills that are in demand throughout the world, really. The question just becomes, how much of a priority do you want to be connected to the history world versus using those same sources in some other way? And that's where it can get a little bit tricky, because, again, if you type historian into a search site, you're not going to get much. If you type it into the U.S. government, the USA Jobs website, you'll find some hits, because there's going to be various, you know, military unit historian positions that are out there. There's, you know, there's historians within the Department of State. There's historians within the Defense Department. So you'll find some hits if you hit historian. But a lot of times you need to be a bit more creative and a bit more expansive in the searches that you're using. So you can look for things like, you know, museums, archives, and basically expand the search out into other areas that utilize those skills that you've learned as a historian. Because, again, it's not easy to find a job that has historian in the title. It's not hard to find a job that actually uses the skills of the historian, though. And so it really depends on what you're comfortable with. If you're comfortable with using those same skills, but putting it towards a more, you know, an industrial application, you probably won't have much of a problem finding a job like that. It's just a matter of looking for the keywords, looking for the skills that are listed in various job listings. They're probably not going to say history, but they're going to talk about all those various skills that I just talked about: critical thinking, source analysis, interpreting sources, collecting vast amounts of data, producing some sort of a document. That type of thing is going to be in demand everywhere. So the difficulty level, It depends. Again, if you want it to specifically be about history, yeah, it's going to be a little bit more difficult because there's a lot of people out there that have either amateur or trained interest in history. There's a lot of folks out there that would love to serve, you know, that would love to work at a museum, even if they're not, academically trained as a historian. So there's going to be a lot of competition for all those jobs. So if you're looking for something specifically history-related, yeah, it's going to be a bit more challenging. But if you're looking for something that's using the skills of the historian, it's not going to be quite as difficult. But it is going to require some creativity as you search for jobs that have those specific skills attached to them. Chanel makes a good comment. You can look for small museums or things near you where you can volunteer or docent. That's a good plan for getting your foot in the door. It's not going to pay, or it's not going to pay very well. But if as a volunteer or a docent, you can at least become known to the people at that institution. And if you're able to demonstrate that you've got the skills they're looking for, then they may bring you on full time. So that is a good, and that kind of goes back to what Luke was talking about, networking and all of that, is that you talk to everybody you can. You look into everything that seems relevant, and something might pay off. The value of networking, of course, is that, yeah, you may not get the job at this museum, but that person may, hey, I know someone at this other museum that is looking for someone, so why don't you apply over there? So it can be word of mouth, it can be networking, but it is going to come from hard work. It's not going to fall in your lap. Back in the old days, which we can all look back on fondly, when the good old days, when, you know, unfortunately it was the good old boys club, but, you know, people could get hired on as a tenure track professor without publishing anything simply because they happened to know the right advisor or something. Those days are long gone and nothing's going to be easy anymore. It's all going to be a lot of competition and a lot of hard work trying to figure out all the keywords and all of that. Hopefully that helps. It's not a happy state of affairs, I will grant you, but it is, it's where we are. I want to thank Luke, Dr. Peterson, for joining me today. This was a really great conversation, and it's a fun book. Those of you that haven't read it yet, it took me back to my old kind of revisionist historian phase back in school, where the book has a... you can tell there's a fire to it. You've got the personal interest in it because there's the argument about the American, not really the American dream, but just the nature of American state and the American institutions and all of that. It felt like there was some serious fire behind that there. So that was really interesting.
Yeah, I call it the American self.
Yes. And so then next up in our history speakers series is we have Dr. Alan York is going to be joining us on May 23rd of 2024. Again, that will be on May 23rd, where Dr. York's going to be talking about his book, Our People Are Warlike, Civil War Pittsburgh and Homefront Mobilization, which is actually near you.
It's right in my backyard.
Pennsylvania folks.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Exactly. Well, great. So that's that. So thank you all for coming and listening to us today. Thanks again, Luke, for joining me. This was a lot
Thanks
of fun.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate everyone's attention, and thank you for your interest in the book. It means a lot to me. Thank you.
Yeah, great. And we will we'll talk again soon.
Sounds good.
And thank you all out there in podcast land for listening. As I mentioned earlier, our next History Speakers event will come on May 23rd, 2024, when Dr. Alan York will talk about his new book, Our People Are Warlike, Civil War Pittsburgh and Homefront Mobilization. Stay tuned for that. If you have any questions or comments about this podcast or any of our other podcasts, please write to workinghistorians@gmail.com. This episode appears on the Working Historians podcast feed, and you can subscribe to that feed on any podcast app, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Podbean, Amazon Music, Pandora, or whatever else you prefer. That way you won't miss any episodes, and you'll continue to hear about all the other cool stuff that historians do with their lives. As always, this podcast does not represent the views of Southern New Hampshire University. But for Luke Peterson, I'm Rob Denning. Be good to yourselves and each other.